Welcome to the FQXI podcast. We'll start off by congratulating Charles Bennett of Johns Hopkins University and the whole WMAP team, who have just been awarded this year's Gruber Prize in Cosmology. WMAP, that's the Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe, launched in 2001 and made precision measurements of the relic radiation of the Big Bang, the cosmic microwave background, which helped to pin down the age, the geometry, the makeup, and the early history of the universe.
WMAP stopped taking data in 2010, but astronomers and cosmologists are still analysing that data to learn more about the makeup of the cosmos. In particular, FQXI member Hiranya Pieris and Stephen Feeney at University College London and their colleagues have been searching for signs of cosmic textures, knots in the fabric of space. I met up with Hiranya and Stephen and asked them about their findings. Hiranya began by running through some of WMAP's biggest hits so far.
The cosmic microwave background, which people call the CMB, is basically the leftover light, the heat from the Big Bang. It was basically released at about 400,000 years after the initial time, at the time when light or photons decoupled from matter and the universe became transparent to light. So those photons at that time were very, very high energy. And since then, the universe has been cooling as it expands, and that light has had its wavelength stretched out by the expansion of the universe. So now that light is in the microwave frequencies, and we observe it mainly as a 3 degree Kelvin above absolute zero background. But there are little fluctuations in that light, which are clues to the origin of structure.
So it's basically giving us a snapshot of what the universe looked like at this very early time after the Big Bang.
That's right. It's the earliest light you can see in the universe. So, of course, the universe existed before this time, but it was opaque to light. And just like when you look at the surface of clouds on an otherwise sunny day where you have this overcast layer of clouds, you can see the surface of the clouds, but you can't see past the surface because the light is scattering in the particles in the clouds. And in the same way, the light before this 400,000-year mark was actually scattering off electrons, and so the universe was opaque before that.
So what sort of things did cosmologists and astronomers hope that WMAP would be able to tell us? And what sort of things has it achieved? What do we now know that we didn't before?
The goal of WMAP was actually not about cosmology, but about measurements. So COBE was, you know, the discoverer of these primordial fluctuations, but it only had a very noisy map of the fluctuations themselves. And the scientific goal of WMAP was to make a much higher resolution, higher sensitivity map of the cosmic microwave background in 5 frequencies so that you could actually separate the emission from the galaxy, which also emits in the microwave, from this primordial light. So that was the purpose. But of course, what that resulted in was a complete revolution in cosmology. It was the start of the era of what we call precision cosmology. So before WMAP, the cosmological parameters that describe the origin, the evolution, the geometry of the universe were sometimes uncertain to factors of 10 and sometimes to factors of 2, you know. But since WMAP, some of those parameters have now been measured to sub-percent precision. So cosmology went from being quite a big idea, speculative, hand-waving science to being a precise science so that we can formulate theories of the early universe that we can't test in the laboratory because this is physics at very, very high energies, and make predictions for the properties of the cosmic microwave background and actually rule out theories, compare theories. I would say that the big hits of WMAP have basically been the measurement of the age of the universe.
How does measuring the cosmic microwave background tell us what the age of the universe is?
Okay, the simplest way that I can explain this is the concept of a standard ruler. What is a standard ruler? An example is the separation of the headlights of a car, Okay, so people have an intuition about how far apart the headlights of a car are. And if you're walking onto a street at night and you can see that there's a pair of headlights with a certain separation, you can have an intuitive feel for how far away that car is and whether it's safe to step out onto the road or not. In the same way, the pattern embedded in the cosmic microwave background fluctuations provides something like a standard ruler. That means that we know how big this ruler is in the early universe. We see it projected onto a certain size on the sky, and by comparing the two, you can figure out how far away the ruler is. And I know that's a statement about distance and not about time, but the two are related in general relativity, and you can work out how old the universe is by comparing the actual size of this ruler to the projected size onto the sky. So now it's known to be 13.7 plus or minus 0.1 billion years. And I think that this is actually stated in the Guinness Book of World Records as the most precise determination of the age of the universe. So this is something that mankind had been, you know, wondering about for a very long time. And that was, you know, the first precise determination. Also, another big question that existed about the universe as a whole was, what was its geometry? Was it open, or was it closed, or was it flat? And WMAP has determined, in combination with other data, that the universe is flat, that it is Euclidean to within a percent.
Is there some way of picturing what that means, what those differences would be?
Yes, so the easiest way that I can think of to describe what this means is by considering what happens to parallel rays of light as they propagate through space. So if it's a flat or Euclidean universe, if you have two rays of light that you set out parallel to each other, they will continue to be parallel to each other when you go to infinity. If it's a closed universe, a spatially closed universe, eventually, even though they're initially parallel, they will meet. And if it's an open universe, they will diverge as you look into infinity. So you can imagine the surface of the Earth, what shall we say, New York City has basically a parallel grid of streets, right? If you can imagine this kind of object in 3D, that's a flat universe, something that you can use Cartesian rules of geometry to compute. So this is actually a very nice thing for students, because I remember when I was an undergraduate and we were doing problems in cosmology, we were given these horrible equations to calculate describing open and closed universes, but we can't set those questions anymore except as just intellectual exercises, because our universe seems to be much simpler than that. So those two are very big questions that it has been able to answer. It's also been able to make the first tests of the physical mechanism that led to the origin of all the structure in the universe. So before WMAP, there were many, many theories for the origin of structure, which I think we're going to talk about in a little bit, and as well as this theory called inflation.
And now, can you just tell us a little bit about what inflation is?
So we know that the present universe is accelerating in its expansion. And probably the best explanation for that, at least at the moment, is that there is a non-zero vacuum energy in space. And that's causing the space to expand very, very rapidly and accelerate in its expansion. So this is called the cosmological constant. And this cosmological constant actually today is very, very small. Okay, but a similar process might have occurred in the very early universe. We are talking about something like 10 to the minus 33 seconds after the initial time. The value of the cosmological constant could have been much, much bigger and caused the universe to expand by a factor of about 10 to the 30 in about 10 to the minus 33 seconds. It's just inconceivable, the process we're talking about. But we see our universe doing that today, so it's not inconceivable that it could have been doing that in the past. So inflation also provides a very elegant mechanism for the origin of structure in the universe. So in this theory, structure originated as quantum mechanical fluctuations in the so-called inflaton field, which is driving this big spurt of growth very early on. So as the universe expanded so rapidly, these little fluctuations were stretched out. And they were stretched out and they got imprinted into universe-sized kind of little ripples in space. And so everything that we see today could have originated from the action of quantum mechanics, which is just mind-boggling, but it's really, really cool.
I like the term universe-sized little ripples. I think only a cosmologist could say that. So that's sort of, you know, we've discussed what WMAP is sort of famous for having achieved, but are there things that we can still look to WMAP for at the moment to find out, you know, more things about the early universe? And here I'm taking you towards a paper that you recently published with Stephen Feeney and other colleagues.
So WMAP itself has basically been turned off. It was turned off in September of 2010 after a very nice period of taking data. It worked beautifully. But this data set can still teach us about new physics that could have occurred in the early universe. I should also say, though, that the Planck satellite, which is a successor to COBE and WMAP, was launched in 2009, and it also has beautiful data, which I can't talk about, but which will be released, at least with the cosmological results, in January in next year. So, you know, we don't have to wait that long for that. But in the meantime, people who are not on the Planck team still use WMAP to do very cool things. So one of them is Stephen Feeney, my student, and he has just been testing an alternative theory for the origin of structure, which used to be one of the contenders back in the day before WMAP. It's no longer a contender for, like, originating all the structure in the universe, but there could still be minor components of the cosmological fluctuations that are sourced by these sort of theories. Two examples are cosmic strings and cosmic textures. So I will pass the mic to Stephen to talk about these.
Well, thank you, Hirania, for that explanation, and hello, Stephen. Can you explain to us what cosmic strings are and what cosmic textures are and how they are related to these sort of to structure formation and things like that, as Hirania sort of introduced there?
As Hirania already began saying, when the universe was very young, it was very hot and dense. And as it expanded, it started cooling. And so we know from lots of much more mundane forms of physics that when you cool things, they can undergo phase transitions. So, for example, you cool liquid water, it will freeze into ice. And when these processes take place slowly, specifically the transition from water to ice takes place very smoothly, you get a crystal that has a very rigid structure all the way through, and it's very uniform throughout. If these processes take place quickly, then the structure of the crystals that you form are only uniform over short distances. And so you can have regions of the crystal that are large distances away that look kind of different. And the interfaces between these regions, you form defects. So, for example, if you look at an ice cube, it's cloudy, right? It's not a kind of perfectly see-through thing. And so there are theories of physics which predict that not only do these phase transitions take place in the early universe, but you will also get defects forming in the universe. And there are a lot of different types of defects that you can get depending on the phase transition that takes place. And so if you get defects that are very long 2D string-like objects, they're called cosmic strings. You can also get kind of sheets forming, which are called domain walls, and if you get a kind of complex phase transition taking place, you can get these weird 3D blobby things called cosmic textures.
So you explained how, you know, if we think about water turning to ice, we have a phase transition and we can see these defects appearing. When we talk about the universe, what are these phase transitions? Are there any examples of what they might be?
So when Hirani was talking about the inflaton field earlier, right, you can have a number of fields in the early universe, and a very famous one of these is the Higgs field, so it's very zeitgeist as the the field which gives us, which gives the particles mass, and high energies, if it has a potential energy associated with it, which gives the field certain symmetries. And as the temperature of the universe cools, the potential that it's in changes, and it can break some of these symmetries, essentially gives the universe choices as to the configuration that it takes. And so whenever something like this happens, you can have one part of the universe going into one configuration and another part of the universe that's further away going into another configuration. And there will be a region within where you have to transfer between these two configurations, and that's where you'll get a defect forming.
And why did cosmologists at one point think these might have been responsible for structure formation, or indeed, you know, what role do they think they could still play today?
Yeah, so if you have a theory which predicts these phase transitions take place, then the defects that are formed have some energy associated with them. And so different defects have different kind of energy densities. So something like a domain wall or a monopole, which is another type, they have a lot of energy associated with them. And so if they form, then they would essentially rule out cosmologies like the ones we see today. So the monopole problem is one of these standard problems of cosmology that Hiranya discussed earlier, insofar as if you have a theory that predicts that they take place, then we shouldn't be here. But there are other types of defects, such as the strings and textures, which are much more benign. And so, I mean, initially they thought that these objects could form the seeds of structure, but as Hiranya said, WMAP managed to rule out textures and strings forming the bulk of the fluctuations that we see in the cosmic microwave background today. However, there's no reason why they can't still have taken place, and they would just be a very small contribution to the CMB that we see. I should add to that that this idea of symmetry breaking is very common in physics, so it's part of the standard model. So at low energies, we have the weak nuclear force and electromagnetism, and we know that at higher energies, these are unified, so kind of reversing that, as you cool, this symmetry is broken, and we expect there to be further phase transitions at higher energies. And so this isn't a kind of far out idea. This is something where a lot of people believe that this should happen, and so there is no reason why you shouldn't see these if that's the case.
So I guess a few years ago, some people did think they might have found something that looked like it might be a texture. So can you talk a little bit about what happened there and what people were looking at?
Yeah, so this is a group. So it's a series of papers by Cruz et al., also featuring Neil Turok, where they looked at a specific feature in the cosmic microwave background, which is known as the cold spot, rather imaginatively. It's a very small feature. It represents about 3% of the data on the full sky. But I think it's probably safe to say that it's by far the most anomalous thing in the CMB, or single feature at least. And so, yeah, I mean, they looked at this data and tried to figure out, well, they tested a number of models to see that could explain why it's so anomalous. So whether or not there's a big void out there, or whether or not it's formed by a texture. I should say, if textures exist in the universe, then they interact with the CMB photons to produce a set of hot or cold spots, all of which should have the same amplitude. And so they thought, well, we've got a cold spot here, let's see whether or not it looks like a texture. And they did, and they concluded that the data were consistent with being explained by a texture. It's a very good analysis. It's just that in these things, this is a kind of global process. We should be looking at the data on the full sky. And so in order to fully test the model, we need to test all of the data on the sky to make sure that it's consistent with textures. And that's a very difficult thing to do because there's lots and lots of data.
And so in this paper that you recently published, what did you do and what did you find?
Essentially, what we did was to look at the full sky WMAP data rather than just a very small patch of it. And in order to do so, we needed to kind of change tack. We need to come up with a way of handling all of this extra data. And the way that we do this is by splitting the algorithm into two parts, the first of which identifies regions on the sky which are the most likely to be textures. And then we assume that all the rest of the sky is just boring and normal. And then we test all of these little patches to see whether or not they're consistent with the texture hypothesis, while still taking into account the fact that textures could be located anywhere on the sky. So this is another Higgs-type thing from the LHC. You have to take account of this look elsewhere effect, right? The theory doesn't tell you where they should be. It just gives you a vague number of how many there should be. And when we look into the full sky data rather than just a little region, we find that there's no real evidence to support the addition of textures into the standard model of cosmology.
You know, you've given such a lovely explanation of why these phase transitions occur and we should see these defects. Is it in some sense surprising that solid evidence for them hasn't been found? Are you basically expecting that there should be some evidence for them?
I guess that's an interesting question. So the number of these defects that you expect to see depends on the specific theory that produces them or the specific symmetry that's broken and when it's broken. So I guess there's always a chance that you could be unlucky and that they take place rarely or high enough energies so that you can't see them in the CMB, so that it would be something that takes place before inflation or something like that. So I guess it's not necessarily surprising that we haven't found them, as they could be weak and there could be a very small number of them. But it would be very cool if we could find them.
So what next? Are you waiting for data from Planck to try and find out a bit more about this question?
Well, so as Hirani was saying, the Planck data is coming out in January, so it's not that long to wait. But yeah, I mean, I gave you a simplification of the results before. When you look into a more full explanation of the results, you do see that there's something interesting in there. So that there is potentially a weak signal. It might just be that the data are too noisy for us to rule out the model completely. With Planck data, this is very exciting because they're better quality than WMAP. There's a kind of factor of 10 or so improvement in noise and stuff, which means that we'll be able to subject this hypothesis to a much more rigorous test and potentially find weaker signals. And also, there are other data sets that we can take advantage of, so polarization data being one of them.
What does this polarization data tell us? What is it, and what new information can it reveal?
The polarization data essentially tells you about the orientation of the light that's coming in, but it also tells you more about what's happened between us and the CMB. And as those photons interact with, for example, textures, you can get different patterns being imprinted on the polarization data. So you can use this as essentially corroborating evidence. So a weak signal in both the temperature data and the polarization data will give you a much firmer conclusion than just one data set.
Okay, so Stephen, you mentioned the Higgs field, and I think, you know, the Higgs has been in the news for the past few weeks, and it probably will be again in the next few days. If there is an announcement made about the Higgs, perhaps the discovery of the Higgs, would that be of interest to you as a cosmologist in any way?
Yeah, I think personally it would, but purely because the Higgs field is a scalar field, and scalar fields are things that a lot of kind of current cosmology is built upon. The inflaton is, the most infamous scalar field, I would say. But they've never been observed, and so this would be the first concrete observation of is a scalar field, something that is quite foundational in cosmology that, I mean, I wouldn't say that people take them for granted, but I might.
That was Hiranya Pyrrhus and Stephen Feeney chatting to Zia. You can find more on the website www.fqxi.org/community, where co-author Matthew Johnson of the Perimeter Institute blogs about the results in more detail.